Don't ask or expect them to express their opinion at that time. They may have an easier time really questioning their beliefs in the privacy of their own mind. 2. Don't make it into a competition or confrontation. The more personal you make it, the more defensive they'll get. Just explore the question together. In fact, it is helpful not to come out swinging, but to begin by asking questions, admitting what you don't know, and then making the topic into a joint quest. 3. Find common ground. As we discussed in the chapter on logical fallacies and how to argue, every argument has premises and logic. If you and someone else disagree, you must be starting with different premises, or one or both of you are using invalid logic. First, find out what you agree on, and then try to identify where you disagree and see if you can resolve the differences together. You may get down to subjective opinions or value judgments, but then at least you'll know where you disagree. Don't fight over facts. Resolve them. Agree ahead of time that you'll simply look up any details in dispute and try to agree on sources you both trust. 4. Don't attack head-on, but rather engage and nurture their skepticism. You may find much more success by not addressing the belief that concerns you the most. Rather, find a topic about which you agree. I have a close friend with whom I disagree a lot, but he saw a good documentary on the Roswell incident and understood why claims of a crashed flying saucer were baseless. That was a topic on which we could agree, and it became a great way for me to mentor his critical thinking. On that topic, without any confrontation, we could discuss what kinds of evidence are useful, how misinformation spreads, and how people can come to fool themselves and believe things that are not true. Everyone is skeptical of something. Find that thing. Rather than try to just convince someone not to believe in something or to accept the scientific consensus on a topic, spend the time to teach them critical thinking skills. Eventually, they may question the belief themselves. 5. Think about your tone. It's amazing how controversial the simple advice to be nice has become within the skeptical community. Phil Plait, the bad astronomer, gave his famous "Don't be a dick" talk at an amazing meeting, a skeptical conference, and received a surprising amount of pushback from people who thought he was being a dick. There is a legitimate controversy here. There is something called tone trolling that occurs in social media. Instead of addressing the points that someone is making, tone trolls nitpick their perceived tone. It's a strategy to push someone out of a discussion or get them to shut up. I have often been told I'm mean just for pointing out a factual error or saying that an argument is a logical fallacy. Tone becomes a misdirection to avoid the real issues and to shout down someone whose opinions you don't like. Further, some people jealously defend their right to have whatever tone they please and to be direct and even ridiculing when they choose. Some issues, they argue, require a forceful tone. I've encountered this attitude when talking to or about con artists or charlatans. They or their defenders demand respect and will commonly tone troll their critics. But whether or not they or their opinions are deserving of respect may be the very question at hand. 6. Try to understand the other person's narrative. We don't just have specific beliefs about facts. We build narratives about how the world works, how to make sense of often overwhelming and confusing information, what motivates other people, and what has happened in the past. If you want someone to change their mind, you cannot simply take away their narrative by telling them they are wrong. That will leave them feeling vulnerable and insecure. You need to replace their narrative with another one that offers better explanatory power, preferably one based on science and reason. In other words, help them make sense of the facts and the claims with your skeptical viewpoint. In the previous Roswell incident example, my friend's narrative was that the government was covering up evidence of a crashed alien flying saucer. My goal was to help them replace that conspiracy narrative with a skeptical one, involving mythology, self-deception, bad media reporting, and some self-promotion by those wanting to sell the conspiracy narrative. With all that in mind, it's likely that with friends and family you want to maintain an amicable relationship. You can probably make all the points you need to make without getting nasty or insulting. it can sometimes be hard to be negative, essentially saying that someone is wrong, without coming off negatively. But it's possible. Just be thoughtful. Whatever approach you decide to take, we have found that this works well for us. We frequently, for example, get confrontational and insulting emails from listeners who disagreed with a segment or perhaps just don't like the sound of Evan's voice or any of Jay's jokes. Our policy is to respond, when we respond, in a professional and polite way. It's amazing how disarming this can be. Often the original emailer will backpedal, even apologize for their initial tone. You don't have to call someone a child. Just model being an adult and let the contrast stand. Finally, if I think someone is worth engaging with, doing it nicely is the only way I seem to make any progress. But again, this is context dependent. Sometimes a sharper knife is needed, depending on your goals. The good news is that people can change, although there is no formula and it's not easy. Psychological research has some encouraging findings that if you take the time to explore arguments and evidence, people can change their mind and come to a more sophisticated understanding of the question at hand. Being a skeptical influence in the lives of people around you will have an impact in the long run. Skeptical parenting. There I was, listening to Gimli, dwarf, warrior, and member of Tolkien's Fellowship of the Ring, give a lecture on breastfeeding to my sister-in-law. No, I wasn't dreaming. Life just takes you to some strange places sometimes. Let me back up. Most years we go to DragonCon, a large convention of everything science fiction, fantasy, and nerdy, to talk for the skepticism and science sections of the conference, and I all the great costumes. One year we went with Jay's wife, Courtney, while she was pregnant with their first child. We got in line to get a picture autographed by John Rhys-Davies, the actor who played Gimli in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. He noticed that Courtney was pregnant and decided to chat with her about whether or not she was going to breastfeed. She was uncertain at the time, and apparently Rhys-Davies had explored the topic thoroughly for his own children. Make no mistake, he was a super nice guy, and it was a pleasant conversation. But he was also a bit of a breast-is-best warrior. Several things occurred to me during that bizarre conversation. The first was that the poor guy had no idea who he was talking to. I wanted to say, "But Gimli, published scientific evidence doesn't support all that typical breast-is-best claims. Putting pressure on mothers to breastfeed can be counterproductive." But there was a line of annoyed fans behind us who probably weren't interested in hearing a debate about the relative benefits of breast milk and formula. Spider-Man in particular was getting a bit jumpy. It also drove home something I had previously observed. Everyone thinks they are entitled to an opinion on certain topics, such as pregnancy and raising children, even when there are complex scientific issues at stake. Not only do people think their opinions are as good as expert reviews or rigorous scientific data, they believe they have almost a duty to share those opinions dogmatically with others, even while in costume at a comic convention. Psychologists call this the illusion of explanatory depth. We tend to think we know how things work, even when we don't. This phenomenon is partly due to the fact that we are used to relying on the expertise of others and confuse it with our own. Most of us drive our cars and use our computers without really knowing how they work. We may overestimate our superficial knowledge of such things and underestimate the technical knowledge of real experts. By a similar mechanism, we feel we are entitled to an opinion about breastfeeding, even when we aren't medical experts. There is also a lot of moral judgment tied up in what are really questions of either medical science or personal preference. If you don't breastfeed, or if you take pain medication during delivery, or if you feed your child anything other than gluten-free, hypoallergenic, organic, free-range kale, you're a bad parent. What this means is that as soon as you announce to the world, or it's apparent, that you are going to have a child, you will be subjected to unsolicited advice of every kind. Encourage critical thinking. Being a skeptical parent means knowing not only how to deal with questions of science regarding having and raising children, but also how to encourage your children to grow into critical thinking adults. I wish I had a formula for guaranteeing such an outcome, But of course, every child is different, and environments vary. As in all things, you can't control your children. You can only influence them. I will also state up front that the general advice of psychologists is to have a loving and nurturing relationship with your child. That comes first. But along the way, you can gently encourage them to be curious, to love science, and to engage in critical thinking. Seize opportunities. When something comes up that you could use as a critical thinking lesson, get into the habit of using it. Show your kids how to question what they see. This is the very beginning of their baloney detector. Essentially, model the good thinking practices you're trying to teach. If they ask a question, don't just give them an authoritative answer, no matter how simple the question. I would give them positive feedback for asking and being curious, then reflect on how interesting the question is and reflect it back. For example, my daughter asked me what color dinosaurs were. That is a deceptively insightful question, because it assumes that the way dinosaurs are typically depicted may not be accurate. I asked her back, well, how could we know what color they were? That's the more interesting question. We then explored it together. I also find it helpful to admit when I don't know the answer, or when even scientists don't know. In fact, with most questions, you can push to the limits of what is known and point out what science has not yet discovered. This teaches several things. It's okay to question anything. Knowledge is not absolute, but is a process of discovery. There is no absolute authority, as any claim is only as good as the evidence that supports it. With this approach, I found that my children became naturally skeptical. They particularly delight in proving me wrong on some detail, which is also an opportunity to model how to behave when confronted with error. Another rule I found helpful, aim a little higher than your instincts tell you. In other words, we tend to assume that children don't understand things, but they probably know and understand more than you think. Avoid talking down to them or underestimating them. Keep the carrot out in front of them and make them reach for it a little, but obviously not too much. At the very least, they'll really appreciate you talking to them as if they were a real person. Giving a love for science. I love science. We all do on the SGU, and we have from a young age. We also have in common the fact that at least one of our parents shared with us their love for science when we were young. This has been the easiest part of being a parent, enthusiastically sharing my love for science with my children. The consensus opinion is that sharing fun quality time with your kids is perhaps the best thing you can do for them. Experts also agree that it is helpful to regularly read to your children and have as many books around as possible. All you have to do, really, is make sure that some of those books and some of that quality time deals with science. I would take my daughters on exploring adventures through the woods in our backyard. If you don't have access to something like that, there are plenty of other things you can do. I would also take them on imaginary journeys through the solar system. This requires no more than a box or even a closet and your imagination. Rather than just tell them about the solar system, I would blast off with them in our imaginary spaceship and we travel to each planet in order. I would describe how long it took to get there, what it looked like from orbit, and what it was like to be on the surface, gravity and all. You can also find something they are interested in and encourage it. Don't force a topic on them. Try out different ones, and when they show interest, run with it. My older daughter became fascinated with birds, for example, while my younger daughter is interested in engineering. The topic doesn't really matter. It could be plants, insects, dinosaurs, the planets, anything. Whatever excites them gives you the opportunity to show how to observe, how categorization works, how scientists know stuff, how to separate reliable claims from common myths, and how to explore a topic through reading. You can also look for ways to show them how the topic they are most interested in relates to other areas of knowledge. Even if you are not a parent yourself, you may have children in your life through friends or family. There are many opportunities to spread a little critical thinking or love for science to those around you at any age. Ultimately, being a skeptical parent is really about being a skeptical person who values teaching and nurturing. We are all students and teachers throughout our entire lives. We never have to stop learning, and no matter what your level of understanding, you have something you can teach others. In fact, teaching is the best way to learn. Teaching and learning are both a dynamic part of the same process. People who are experienced or who have a deeper fund of knowledge than you have a lot to share. But those with less experience or knowledge also have a lot to share, their enthusiasm and their fresh perspective. The most penetrating and insightful questions often come from those with no preconceptions. This is why children may sometimes ask the best questions, because they don't know enough to have hidden assumptions that constrain their thinking. Such questions are an opportunity for you to confront assumptions you did not know you were making. This student-teacher approach is also the approach we take on the SGU. We are teaching and learning at the same time, as part of the same process. I don't expect my endless process of teaching and learning will end until I do. Epilogue. Being a member of the skeptical community has been one of the most fulfilling adventures of my life. It has been a personal intellectual journey and a collective journey with those close to me. Through the community, and especially through the Skeptic's Guide podcast, I have been able to expand that circle by orders of magnitude. It has been fun, enlightening, frustrating, and empowering, and I know it is a journey that will never end. One of the most common observations our regular listeners make is that while listening, they feel as if they're the sixth rogue in the room, just the silent one. The show for them is more than just an educational tool or a means of distraction while performing mindless tasks. For many, it is a connection with like-minded friends, and we love to hear that because it's exactly what we're going for. For many, it is also an escape to reality. It can often feel like the world is crazy, and it's nice to know there are other people out there who value science, logic, and reason. If this audiobook was your introduction to the SGU and to skepticism, then I hope you found it a valuable and entertaining one. It may have even pissed you off in some sections, and that's good. That means we successfully challenged something you care about, perhaps more than you thought. To close out, we'd like to leave you with one final thought. Don't trust us. This might sound strange after listening to an audiobook, but the point is, you shouldn't really trust anyone when it comes to empirical knowledge. Think for yourself. If something is important, verify it as best you can. We do all need to rely on experts and other people as sources of information, but at the same time, we should strive to understand how we know what we know. Why do experts have the opinions they do? Is there more to the story? Everyone makes mistakes, including us. I hope we didn't make any here. We try our best, but error is unavoidable. All we can do is be open to correcting them when they come to our attention. I think over the years, we may have learned as much collectively from our listeners as they have from us. Almost every week, someone who is a world expert on a narrow topic we discussed writes in to give us more information. Listeners give us new perspectives, or fill holes in our discussion, or even challenge our facts or arguments. I do think this is the most positive thing about new media. It's interactive. We're not just talking to our listeners. We're having a conversation on the show that we're happy to bring our listeners into when they have something to add. One of our goals for this book is that it too will become part of the conversation. It's the guide to the Skeptic's Guide. We have often been asked for a thorough guide to all the concepts we reference regularly on the show. Well, here it is. Hopefully, this is just one more step on the endless journey of critical inquiry. Until next time, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Acknowledgements. We are so grateful to the many mentors and science communicators who taught and inspired us for decades. Carl Sagan, Isaac Asimov, Stephen Jay Gould, Eugenie Scott, Joe Nickell, Paul Kurtz, James Randi, Martin Gardner, Mary Roach, Bill Nye, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Oliver Sacks, and many others. Yes, even Leonard Nimoy, are the giants on whose shoulders we stand. In addition, we are part of a vibrant, supportive community of fellow skeptics who encourage us every day in their careers and daily acts to make the world a little more rational. At the top of this list are our SGU listeners, who have taught us as much over the years as we have taught them. We would like to thank every listener who has ever sent us an email, a question, feedback, pedantic correction, suggestion for the show, or just taken the time to tell us how we have contributed to their lives. And especially, we are grateful to our members and patrons who support our work. Perry DeAngelis, to whom this book is dedicated, was a founding member of the New England Skeptical Society and the SGU, and was no doubt responsible for much of its early success. Perry passed away in August 2007, but his influence will always remain. Mike LaSalle started as our self-proclaimed number one fan, but became a close friend and behind-the-scenes worker bee. We also lost him much too early. Rebecca Watson was part of the show for 9 years, from its early days of obscurity, adding her unique style and wit, and helping to shape the tone and popularity of the SGU. Fellow podcaster, skeptic and musician George Fraub has been a frequent guest on the SGU and is our partner in crime in so many other ways. He developed a stage extravaganza with us, shot videos, helped produce live streaming shows, and other special projects. More important, he is one of our closest friends and a selfless supporter of our shared mission. We have developed close ties of collaboration and friendship around the world, especially with our many friends down under, Richard Saunders, Aran Segev, Rachel Dunlop, Joe Benamu, and the New Zealand Skeptics. We have had the privilege of working with many other collaborators and volunteers as well, including Liz Gaston, Phil Hudson, Douglas Sabone, David Young, Jake Wilson, Ian Callahan, Joel Bellucci, Reed Gower, Kernan Coleman, all our friends at the Northeast Conference of Science and Skepticism, everyone who helped on our video projects, everyone who has ever made Jay laugh, and that guy who did that thing. You know who you are. This book is just the latest of our projects that was helped along by many hands. Thanks to Richard Wiseman for his advice and example early in the process, Kira Wilhelm for suggesting our subtitle, our agent, Rob Kirkpatrick, for helping make this project a reality, the tremendous work of our editor, Maddie Caldwell, and all the people at Grand Central Publishing for their work on this audiobook. We especially have to thank our family and close friends who have supported us, helped us, and put up with us over the years. We could not have maintained this project without the love, support, and hard work of Jocelyn Novella, Courtney Novella, Jennifer Bernstein, and Gabriel Lewis. Most important, the Novella brothers owe their lifelong love of science, science fiction, and critical thinking to their father, Joe Novella, who, over pasta and meatballs, inspired the conversations that became the SGU. Finally, for those of you being introduced to skepticism for the first time through this audiobook, our hope is that you will be inspired, in a small way or a big way, to change the world.
We're here today in the middle of September 2018 in downtown New Haven, Connecticut at Firehouse 12 Studios with Dr. Stephen Novella, who has just finished recording the audio you've been listening to. Just an interesting side note, the name Firehouse 12 has a historical significance because the studio was built about 10 years ago in a totally renovated early 1900s brick building that originally housed the actual Firehouse Engine No. 12 in New Haven for many years. Dr. Novella is joined in studio by his co-authors Bob Novella, Jay Novella, Evan Bernstein, and by phone line from California, Kara Santa Maria. Welcome to all of you. Maybe we can start with you, Stephen. Tell us how recording the audiobook, how this experience has been different from doing your podcast.
Thanks, Pete. The experience is very different. First of all, recording the book was just me alone in a booth. You know, it was like being in solitary confinement. And I was reading the book and, you know, performing the book, not having a conversation. The podcast is very conversational. Even when one of us is taking the lead, as we say, on a specific topic, we try to make it as conversational and unscripted as possible, and then we just sort of clean it all up in the editing. Whereas this was like reading a script, you know. So it was a completely different skill set. Although, you know, being used to being in front of a microphone absolutely did help.
What was the collaborative writing process like for all of you in writing this book?
This is Bob. The process was impacted, I think, early on, very early on, by the decision to make the book in Steve's voice. So he essentially had to have a hand in everything that was written down. So what we did was we took everyone but Steve took different areas, different topics. We wrote about it almost as if it were a chapter in the book, but it didn't have to be finely polished because Steve would then take that and kind of rearrange it a little bit to put it into his own words so that it would be comfortable coming, you know, it would be more Steve-like rather than Bob-like or Jay-like.
This is Evan. We had initially talked about a process by which we were going to have ultimately multiple voices speaking for this book or speaking about this book. But then in the end, we came to the conclusion it would just be better if it was in the singular book, easier for the readers and the listeners to follow and understand. And I think that was a good choice.
This is Jay. Yeah, plus we also all found out that this was a massive Herculean effort and that all the cool ideas that we wanted to put into the book, we couldn't do. We wanted to have like Easter eggs in there and we wanted to have like, you know, a lot of illustrations and all this stuff. And then when reality sunk in, it really just came down to a place that was rational that we can get done in the time that we wanted to get it done. But I have to say, you know, Steve, this is largely Steve's effort. He was the one that was staying up till 2 a.m, you know, just typing the hell out of this book. You know, we're feeding him information, but Steve, you know, is the one that made this thing come to life. And I'm super proud of you and Steve, and I'm psyched that you finished the audiobook today.
This is Kara. You know, it's always interesting to work on a project with 5 different people living in 5 different places. We would talk each week when we would record the podcast about what to do next and where to go from there. But we also kept a lot of online spreadsheets and were very collaborative in deciding who would write what chapter, who maybe had more knowledge about that chapter or had the time to be able to dig deep. Really, putting the book in Steve's voice made the most sense for you, for the reader, because it has a great flow. It has a narrative arc. It's easy to dive in when the tone isn't being shifted from chapter to chapter. But there is one section of the book, Adventures and Skepticism, where those chapters were pretty much kept in our voices because we each shared our own personal stories.
That's right. That was the most challenging chapters for me to read because, like, I had to read these chapters in your voice, not my own voice.
Oh, so did you put on any – did you change your voice at all?
I mean, a tiny little bit. I mean, I didn't, like, you try to imitate your voice.
That would have been awesome.
But, yeah, whenever I was reading somebody else, whether it was a quote or your chapters, there was a little bit of a different lilt to my voice. It wasn't in, like, my voice.
Yeah. Can you give me an example of Kara right now? Like, what'd you do for Kara?
Well, as I said, I didn't imitate anybody's voices. It was, you know what I mean? It was subtle.
It was subtle. A lost opportunity.
I thought about it for a minute. I'm like, all right, well, how would I imitate Jay in the most embarrassing way
Thanks,
possible?
Steve. That's
but
perfect.
I decided to spare the listeners.
Let's not forget, too, guys, this was a lot of fun. This was a ton of fun.
Yeah, it was fun for you guys.
Yeah.
No, but you weren't writing it. But yeah. No, it was. I'm just joking. It was a lot of fun. I do like collaborating in big projects like this. It is better than toiling by yourself, I think. And also just I love bouncing ideas off of other people. Early on, we had so many different ideas for like how to skin the book. Like what kind of other extra things are we going to do? Like, you know, we had the idea of maybe making the book like a video game where the listener would achieve certain things as they went through it. Lots of ideas that would have been way too cumbersome to actually pull off in a book.
Yeah.
And then we had to.
And hard to pull off.
And
yeah.
Hard to pull
off. Yeah, challenging.
And then we pared it down to I think the idea was, all right, these are the core concepts. These are really the meat that every critical thinker needs to know. And then we built the book essentially around that idea.
How about an early idea? Weren't we talking about having this was a guidebook from an alien civilization about, you know, the world culture of Earth? And that would have been interesting too, but extremely hard to pull off.
Well, we wanted to start every chapter kind of like a quote from the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe intergalactic book that doesn't actually exist. Remember that?
Right, and you know what? What's interesting is that the book retained a little bit of an element of that, because each chapter begins with Skeptic's Guide entry and then the entry name and then like also see and section that doesn't correlate with this book. It actually correlates with this mythical book that exists that we're writing about. So that there's a little bit of a tendril of that idea left over in the book.
We wanted to take that way too far.
Yeah, we wanted to take it beyond all reason, because that's how we roll. Yeah.
Were there any times when you'd be stuck or have writer's block in the writing process, and knowing that obviously all this material has been in the works for quite some time, were there any specific things you found that helped you to find inspiration to get through this?
So, I mean, the short answer to that is no, because this is, you know, it's not like a work of nonfiction where there's a ton of creativity. This is, because it's nonfiction and because I've written about all of these topics before, this, and we've been talking about all of this content for the last 12 years, you know, before we wrote the book, we had way more material than we needed. It really, the process was more paring it down. It wasn't so much, now what do I write? We had it. We had more than enough raw material.
Which of these 12 options do we keep and which do we exclude? That was the really...
There were some Sophie's choices about like what do we cut? You know, we had to combine chapters in a lot of ways. And the book still ended up being longer than I think it was originally planned. But that was really the opposite. We had more content than we needed.
We almost had double... There was two books worth of content here easily.
Yeah. Oh, easily, yes. I would say.
But let's be honest here. Writing is not easy. And so even though we had a lot of content and even though we had an awful lot of, bullet points, when it comes to sit down and put this stuff in paragraph form and, you know, play with turns of phrase and get the concepts that you want to get out there in a very clear and digestible way, I don't know if I could say that, you know, we ever really got stuck, but I dealt with writer's block plenty of times. I think that's pretty common for most writers. And so, yeah, you have to kind of get up, you have to walk around, you have to do the different things that you can do to figure out how to put those ideas into words in the best way possible.
Yeah, I think the only time I could say, like, I was quote-unquote stuck was when I was trying to think of a very specific example. You know, it's like, all right, I know what I need to say. I need sort of a fun, real-world example of this specific thing that I'm trying to explain. And that would take some creative thought.
Yeah, like a logical fallacy. Like, what's a good
example of this logical fallacy? Mm. And I didn't want to just reuse all the ones that we've used over again. I wanted fresh examples. So that was the most creative aspect of writing the book.
How did the whole concept of a podcast start?
That's a good story.
That's a great story, yes.
Love it.
We are all big fans of like superheroes and gaming, and you know, we've been playing online games as long as online games have been available to play. And we happened to be playing this game called City of Heroes, and we had a regular night. And you know, we had people come and go, but it was largely, you know, Bob, Steve, Evan, and I. This was before we knew Kara.
And Perry.
But definitely Perry was probably the funniest person out of all of us that played it. So what happened was one of our friends, Shane Brown, was playing with us, and he became aware of podcasting. I think podcasting had existed at that time for a month.
Yeah, it was.
And it was like
right at the end
right
of 2004.
And he said, "You know, guys, we talk about politics a lot when we're playing the game. Why don't we do this thing called a podcast? What's that? You know, it's a radio show. Oh yeah, cool. Well, Stephen Perry wanted to do a radio show at one point, so we were interested. But what Steve did." Because we were already skeptical activists, Steve said, "That's a great idea, Shane, but we're not going to do a political podcast and we're not going to do it with you. We're going to do a skeptics podcast." And that was it. and it happened just like that.
Thank you for the idea, Shane. We love you.
Yeah, but Shane he wasn't a skeptic like us. You know, wasn't an activist.
Yeah. No.
And we really, you know, it was a good idea because the political podcast would have been a train wreck, right? Because we all, you know, we have varying degrees and there would have been a lot more arguing. But as soon as the idea of the podcast came into life, right away, Perry came up with the title of the podcast. Steve came up with the format. We were all throwing ideas into the ring. And I think 2 weeks later, after that night, we recorded our first podcast.
Yeah, it gelled very quickly. After
and
that.
Haven't missed one yet.
Well, that we did. The first 6 months was touch and go. But after that, once we caught the groove.
Yeah, we
did we miss some?
We missed a couple of weeks in the first like 3 to 4 months. But then once we decided, we have to do this every week.
I have a false memory. Okay,
we haven't missed a week in, so now we could say like 13 years.
Yep.
How does the SGU handle the question of God and religion?
We handle it very well, thank you.
Well, I talk to God every day. It's my wife, and I do whatever she says.
we have a specific attitude about it, and the great thing about skeptics and being in the skeptical community, you could handle that specific nut in a lot of different ways. You could tackle it directly. You could tackle it obliquely. There's lots of whatever you want to do. That's what you should do. What we decided early on was to not confront it directly. If say a religion came up with a specific claim about, the earth is 6,000 years old, we would address a scientific claim. But addressing the faith, we decided that it would be best if you handled it in a way like, first you teach them give them a skeptical toolkit and then have them decide for themselves, apply those newfound rules to the religion.
Yeah, so I think the distinction, sort of editorial policy, is we don't really distinguish between believing in God or not believing in God or religion or no religion. It's really the differences between faith and science, right? Is this a scientific claim? Is there anything to do with critical thinking or empirical claims here? If so, then we will tackle the empirical claims. So like there is a chapter in the book on intelligent design. It's obviously a very religious issue, but we're not attacking anybody's faith. We're talking about the scientific claims that proponents of intelligent design are making. So it's very easy to stick with the science and critical thinking and address everything we need to address without making a direct aim at anyone's personal faith.
It's difficult because when you broach a topic like religion or say politics, right, those are the classic two examples, we find that the shields go up. The shields go up, and it's very, very hard to penetrate it. But if you can kind of get them from behind and have them think about critical thinking and then apply those skills, I mean, that's what happened to me. I mean, I was never very religious. I just didn't really think much or care much about religion, but I believed. But then after being a certain level into the community and our activism, one day I just thought about it, I'm like, well, of course, it's baloney. It just was so obvious, and I just built up a critical mass of critical thinking skills that made it pretty clear to me where I stood.
And also, there's nothing within the skeptical movement that says you can't be religious, you can't have certain levels of faith, you can't, think about these things in a way that makes sense to you. And the last thing we would want to do is create some sort of closed group that's not open to all people of all different ideas. The point here is that we are concerned about religious claims that fly in the face of scientific evidence. So that's what we focus our attention on when we go into that area. But otherwise, plenty of people out there manage to be, strong scientists, strong scientific thinkers, and also have a personal religion, and they're able to square that circle, no problem.
Yeah, you can have your science and your religion too. There's no problem, as long as you keep the spheres separate.
So is there a particular stance from the scientific skeptic just on the whole question of whether there is or isn't a God?
It's an unanswerable question.
So, and again, I think that what Jay articulated was sort of our philosophical position, which is to be agnostic, meaning that if you pose a question that cannot be answered empirically, then no one can claim to have the definitive answer to that question. So the problem is you can't refer to scientific skepticism as if it's like one thing. There certainly isn't any organization or any group or anybody who claims to be the definitive authoritative source of opinion or belief that we call scientific skepticism. We often refer to movement skeptics as trying to herd cats, right? I mean, part of our DNA is to think individually. And so I can't say that we represent anything but ourselves, So all I could say is, for me personally and the editorial approach that the SGU has taken is that we take an agnostic approach towards unanswerable questions, except to define them as being outside the realm of science. So if you're positing a God that cannot be falsified, even theoretically, that's all we would say about that is, all right, that position is outside the realm of knowledge. You can believe whatever you want about it. But it's not a scientific question.
But if we were to bet some money on it.
Yeah, we have our own personal beliefs, right.
Were there any chapters or any material that ended up on the cutting room floor, so to speak, that did not make it into the book? How did you decide what to keep?
Well, now we go back to the year 1996.
Yes.
Right.
In which Steve and Bob and Perry, myself, and shortly afterwards Jay, we decided that Connecticut needed its own local skeptics group because we were not locally being really represented by anyone, by any organization, and there were other local organizations that existed around the country at that time. So between Steve and Perry, they decided, let's get this thing going and let's get the Connecticut Skeptical Society up and running. And within a year or two, that branched out and we encompassed all of New England and became the New England Skeptical Society. We were largely, again, a local skeptics group who hosted a monthly lecture series in which we would just use a room at a library, invite people to come in, and we'd invite in some people who have written books or were professors at universities to talk about skeptical topics, that a lot of which we talk about on the show and are referred to in this book. And we did that for quite some time. We kept it going for the better part of 11 years doing that. And it became, once the podcast came along, we sort of shifted our efforts away from having to organize the local meetings and those sorts of things so that we could reach out to a much wider audience, something more national, something more international through the podcast.
Yeah, so the NES still exists as an entity. And right now, primarily what we do is co-run the Nexus, which is an annual science and critical thinking conference that's been mainly held in New York City. We co-run that with the New York City Skeptics. That's the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism. The NES also hosts science-based medicine. But what's happened is once social media hit, the entire landscape of science and critical thinking promotion, the skeptical movement, completely shifted. And, you know, efforts shifted from a local focus to an online focus. And so did we. So we started blogging and doing a podcast. And then the only thing, you know, meetup groups started organizing online as well. So that kind of obviated the need for us to run local meetings because meetup groups kind of took over that. And so we essentially were left with running Nexus, running the annual conference.
Yep.
Remember some of the early, in the early days of the NES, we were thinking, what could we use to be our symbol for the NES? We were thinking of Nessie.
Yeah.
The Loch Ness Monster.
Loch Ness Monster. And we're like, nah, that's kind of weird.
It goes against what we're really doing.
Remember, we had the New England Journal of Skepticism, which kind of played into the NES, which was a great,
that was our quarterly newsletter.
Yeah.
Right.
Which I think, Steve, you came up with that name to mimic, of course, the obvious. And, so that was pretty fun. Do you remember when we were talking about, we loved the NES. We loved that acronym. Remember, we wanted to keep it, but still expand. So we're thinking maybe the Northeast Skeptical Society. Yeah. And just some goofy stuff we were thinking early on.
But I think the one thing that we still do, when this is opportunistically, is investigations. Because we did a lot of investigations early on. And I think we would still do them whenever we can.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's right. That was fun. A lot of work.
Have there been any updates with the content of this book since it was written?
Yeah, I mean, there were entire sections that were in the original outline of the book that ended up getting cut, and also chapters, like what is a core concept? For example, like we wrote about GMOs, but we didn't have a chapter dedicated to, for example, anti-vaccine movement or climate change denial. So there's so many different things that we could have used as examples that we could have taken on. We didn't write about astrology, about Bigfoot, there's so many different topics in here. We really had to just pick a few representative examples out of probably hundreds that made it onto our initial list. And there was a section that we were thinking about that ended up getting completely cut. Remember what that was?
We're going back over a year now.
Yeah, I know. I know we cut a whole section out. I'm trying to remember what it was.
Kara, do you remember?
Well, I do remember that we had some very high hopes for basically working every single podcast segment somehow into the book.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
So we were going to do pop-outs for every single different thing. First, Forgotten Superheroes and What's the Word? And,
Cookie
I don't know how we were going to put noisies in there.
Yeah, right?
we kept some of that. But yeah, but no Forgotten Superheroes. That got cut. I think I remember it. We were going to do a section on controversies, and that got cut.
Yeah, we wanted to also do, go to this web link mm-hmm. to get more content. Remember, we were going to do that surplus.
Yeah, we can still do that.
Sure, we can, but we can't embed it into the printed book anymore. Right. Yeah.
Are there any plans for follow-up books?
Absolutely. Yeah, so we track the literature all the time, every week. You know, we talk about it on the show. And ever since the final edit was done, like I couldn't make any more additions to the book. Every time an article comes out that is relevant, I'm like, crap, I would have loved to have put that in the book.
Yeah.
Like just in the last month, there were two different studies on conspiracy theories that would that would have fit right into the conspiracy chapter. But it's endless. Of course, that's never going to end.
That's why when Carl Sagan wrote The Demon Haunted World in the 90s, you know, the book at this point it's gotten to the point where all the information is old. It's all dated, mm-hmm. even though it's a wonderful book. And for most of us, it was like a very important book.
It's still very relevant, but yes, there's a lot of, and whenever he talks about like the psychology of belief or explaining, how do you get people to change their mind or just our knowledge of conspiracy thinking or any of those things where there's been 20 years now of psychological research. Yeah, I mean, there was a ton of stuff. And all the references in our book, or the vast majority of them, are in the last 5 years. You know, they're stuff that was published, you know, if you look through, it's all 2016, 2017. I even stuck a 2018 reference in there. So, but at some point, it's done, right? It's done. But if you listen to the show, you'll hear almost every week some new bit of information that is continuing this endless process of understanding why people believe the things that they do, why they deny science, how to change their mind, what strategies are effective or not effective, et cetera.
Yeah, and in 20 years, some young skeptical punks are going to be saying, yeah, this SGU book is good, but man, is it way out of date. We've got to rewrite this.
We can keep updating it, yeah.
Steve and I are going to start seriously working on Forgotten Superheroes of Science. And then the other guys are going to kind of focus on, it's like a conspiracy book, right? Just like major conspiracies or controversies.
That's on the list. Controversies is on the list. But I think we're going to do things that everyone knows that are not true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And while we're working on the Forgotten Superheroes of Science. And we're still always brainstorming, what's the next book ideas? Well, I have to write a book just on science-based medicine at some point. So we already have 3 or 4 books in the queue, but that's also sort of a work in progress, you know, how to prioritize that list.
Yeah, we want to wait for this book to come out, and by the time you're hearing this, it will be out, and we'll be working on one or more of these ideas.
Yeah,
that'll
right.
be out.
What projects are you all working on individually or as a group other than The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe?
We have some great stuff. So, Evan, you actually have a second podcast now.
I started a new podcast in 2018 with Perry DeAngelis' sister, Celeste. She's the host of the show. And it's called Which Game First. It's a podcast about games, board games and card games, in which we sit around the table, we play the games, and we review them for you, the audience, to listen to. It's kind of a throwback because we don't talk about video games at all. It's all analog. It's all the
well,
good,
Adams,
good
not
stuff.
This.
Good stuff. And for all ages. I mean, we're playing some kids board games. We're playing some, you know, obviously adult board games, with proper content, proper mature content. And also some very old throwback games to like the 1930s and 40s that we're trying to dig up. So it's been positively reviewed so far. And we're enjoying it very much. And, of course, all of us here at The Skeptic's Guide enjoy games of all mm-hmm. sorts. And it's kind of how we all became friends initially.
And, Kara, you do this as your full-time job. So you're working on a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
I am. I'm a full-time freelance science communicator. So I have another podcast, Talk Nerdy with Kara Santamaria. I actually started that before I joined The Skeptic's Guide. I started that podcast in March of 2014. And that airs every week. I also am a correspondent on Explorer on National Geographic, and I am the co-founder and co-run an annual science communication training retreat called SciComm Camp, where we work to improve training opportunities and networking opportunities for early career and some advanced level science communicators as well. And lastly, I have decided after a long break, a break of about a decade, to go back to school. So I'm in training now to complete a PhD in clinical psychology. My concentration is social justice and diversity, and my orientation is existential psychology.
Wow. Well, that makes what I'm about to say sound kind of ridiculous.
but awesome.
Bob, Steve, and I, well, you know, all of us on the SGU, we would throw in a movie review on the podcast, and usually it was a science fiction movie that we were reviewing.
And then ripping apart.
Yeah. Yeah. We would take it from a you know, we take the science perspective on, say, Prometheus, which, you know, the whole world loved to hate. But what we decided to do was that we just wanted to do a science fiction show and just have this be more fun oriented and not so much, you know, something as serious as critical thinking and trying to educate people. We just want to have fun. So just like, you know, Evan, you know, we decided to do something in movies or gaming or whatever. So we do a science fiction review show. It's called Alpha Quadrant 6. And, you know, the last couple of episodes we did like the top 10 best robots in science fiction.
Yeah.
Or the best, you know, starships in science fiction. And then we do a movie reviews and TV show reviews. And we love it. It's easy to do. It's fast. It's fun. And we're laughing the whole time.
And let's be honest. At least a little bit of this had to be motivated by the fact that I was constantly complaining when the guys would say, hey, we're going to watch another sci-fi movie today and we're going to review it on SGU. And I was like, please don't make me do that.
Yeah, but then, Kara, when we go to Dragon Con with you, we make you wear the Star Trek uniform. So you're not going to get away from this. Just admit it to yourself. You're stuck with it.
Oh, I've fully accepted this now. I'm one of us.
She's woke to Star Trek and Star Wars.
Welcome.
She's been assimilated.
I love Alpha Quadrant 6. I really want to run with this. I'm a big, huge science fiction geek nerd. Oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, and when we did the robot review, I brought my robots. So when we're talking about Robbie the robot, I had one right there.
Yeah.
I said, how many should I bring? Should I bring like all 100 of them, or I'll just bring a subset of them? When we talked about ray guns, blasters, I brought my collections to talk about it, to have it. Nothing like having it right there when you're talking about it on a video review show.
Yeah, but Bob, you've been training for the show your whole life.
Yes.
your collection is a joke compared to my blaster collection, though.
What are you talking about?
See, they're starting to do the show right now. You've got to be so careful.
Okay. Next question.
I have the most lightsabers, so let's just get that
straight. Okay.
Yeah, but did you make a display to hold like 10, 12 of your blaster ray guns, Jay? No,
okay,
I did.
You
and it's on the set.
You got me.
And it's on the set.
We look forward to whatever projects you all individually or as a group have coming up in the future. We'd like to thank Stephen Novella, Bob Novella, Jay Novella, Evan Bernstein, and Kara Santa Maria for taking the time to speak with us today and giving us some more insights into The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Thank you.
Hi, this is Stephen Novella. I am the producer and host of The Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, this is Bob Novella. If you're listening to someone speak very enthusiastically about, say, astrophysics or astronomy or quantum mechanics, that's going to be me.
Hi, I'm Evan Bernstein. I'm one of the co-hosts of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast.
Hi, this is Jay. I'm Bob and Steve's little brother.
Only in age.
I don't say that anymore.
You don't.
Now, I'm a co-host on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and I'm also a co-producer working with Steve day in and day out on running this business and this podcast that we love so much.
Yeah, I get to order Jay around, basically.
Hey guys, I'm Kara Santa Maria. I do the What's the Word section on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and most of my stories involve neuroscience, psychology, or science journalism.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, How to Know What's Really Real in a World Increasingly Full of Fake. Written by Stephen Novella with Bob Novella, Kara Santa Maria, Jay Novella, and Evan Bernstein. Read by Stephen Novella. Produced by Elise Green. Directed by Pete Pantelis. Recorded by Greg DeCrosta at Firehouse 12 Studios, New Haven, Connecticut. Post-production by Chris Howerton. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by SGU Productions, LLC. Audio production copyright 2018. Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.